This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 26th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 172nd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today, we speak to one of the Culture Show's heroes, the leader of the wonderful Water Boys, Mike Scott. He speaks to Andrew Muller.
I'm wearing a cowboy hat and I'm looking so a bit spaced out, and he's such a freak. And I thought, yeah, man, I'm still a freak. I never went straight.
We'll get a pleasant shudder of nostalgia as we head to a show dedicated to those unassuming design classics, Lady Bird Books.
It's an unreal world, but at the same time, it captures the imagination of those that did grow up in that period, and in many ways there's all sorts of truisms of what life was like.
And we'll investigate the amazing, hilarious, heartbreaking story of the only man in the village who didn't win a share of Spain's famously gargantuan lottery win. We'll assess the influence of the up-and-coming art fair in Singapore and get down to a great Midori House session from Alex Bury. We really hope you enjoy it all. It's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Alex Bury is a 19-year-old producer and musician from South London, but don't be fooled by his youthful age. This guy's been making music for quite a while. From the tender age of 11, he was known locally as the go-to guy for grime MCs seeking backing tracks, which were created in his bedroom at his parents' house. He's since graduated to the shed at the end of the garden, where he's built himself a studio to perfect the multi-layered ideas behind his new EP, Inside World. And the result is quite lovely. It's a well-polished collection of songs with a soulful lilt and an electro lift. It's a far cry from the connotations one might associate with the amateur teenage grime. Alex Bury came to Midori House with a rather full band to play us a few tracks, and here he is with Inside World.
My blood, a waterfall of love. And when we wake to air that glows, only those in love would know. Shine onto your pillows through the weeping willows. Chains release my brain. I've sustained and will go on the same. Something free, take it easily. By midnight, my eyes will glow in white. I'll be your delight. Thank you.
That was Alex Bury performing Inside World, and we'll hear more from him later. Off we go to the seaside, first of all, to one of the world's loveliest galleries, the De La Warr Pavilion in Bexhill-on-Sea on England's south coast, for a new show called Lady Bird by Design. Ah, Lady Bird books. They were my favourite things in the world when I was a kid, dealing as they did with the most fascinating things. Natural history, how things work, the monarchs of England, and best of all, people at work. The iconic little hardback books were sensibly didactically written by unnamed authors and illustrated quite beautifully by Lady Bird's own team of artists. Working across series with titles as wonderfully evocative as What to Look For, Well-Loved Tales and, of course, Shopping with Mother. The show at De La Warr comprises the original illustrations, plenty of those books in glass cases, and endless wonder. Lady Bird by Design is co-curated by Jane Wan, head of exhibitions at De La Warr, and Lawrence Zegan, Dean of Design at the London College of Communications, and I spoke to Lawrence about the draw of the drawings and the wonder of Lady Bird.
Lady Bird this year is 100 years old. The universe that we're looking at as part of the exhibition is of a particular kind of golden era of the 50s, 60s and 70s in Lady Bird's history. It's a world where there are no cracks in the pavement, there's no litter, there's no chewing gum, there's no graffiti. It's a kind of perfect, idyllic, utopian view of what post-war Britain was like. As a child of the 60s myself, I believe that they were real. They were enthusiastic, they were energetic, they were always extremely well behaved. The relationship that Peter had with his sister Jane was unlike the relationship I had with my sister Astrid. We were fighting the whole time. We wouldn't do science experiments together or go down to the woods or help daddy in the garden in the same kind of way that the pair of them did. So it's an unreal world, but at the same time it captures the imagination of those that did grow up in that period. And in many ways there's all sorts of truisms of what life was like. Lady Bird illustrators were a group of jobbing artists. They were scattered all over the country. They were actually men of a certain age. Many of them had served in the Second World War. Many of them were also working for ad agencies. They were doing jobbing commercial work as well. And the one thing that glued them all together was the kind of aesthetic that was commissioned of them, and Douglas Keane, who was the editorial director, had a very particular view of how the illustrations had to look and how the world needed to be portrayed. The drawing skills of the Lady Bird illustrators were really second to none, and the craftsmanship is quite staggering. And I think that's just a fantastic thing to see. Some of this work is 50 years old, it's only half a century, but how the world has changed, society's changed, but also the techniques in illustration and design have changed immeasurably as well.
I mean, we're looking now at kind of one of the sort of elephants in the room, I suppose, one of the most famous titles published by Penguin, Shopping with Mother, which shows a series of kind of really hyper-ordinary but sort of exceptionally beautiful scenes of sort of everyday life. You can maybe talk us through a couple of them in a minute, Lawrence, but there is a strange, as you suggested, a crossover between the materials and the subject matter, the fact that people were able to paint this beautifully. You know, it was their job. And so much of the Lady Bird universe is about how people do their jobs. But maybe you can talk us through a couple of these bewitching scenes from Shopping with Mother.
Shopping with Mother is about a brother and sister duo going out with Mummy to the high street. We've got Mother looking actually very 40s. She's got a suit on, skirt, jacket. She's wearing a scarf, she's wearing a kind of pillarbox hat, and she's carrying a rather attractive wicker basket to do the shopping in. The little boy is wearing his school uniform, so he's got grey socks on that are not ragged or hanging down by his ankles, but absolutely pulled up to his kneecaps. The little girl she looks slightly more casual. She's got a beautifully smart red coat on, and she's holding a smaller wicker basket emulating her mother. And the simple narrative is of the three of them wandering the high street and doing the daily shop. The beautifully articulated images are of a high street in its heyday. There are no charity shops, there are no shops boarded up, there's no one selling outside begging, there's no big issue sellers, there's no double parking, there's no red route. This is a brilliantly simple world where they're greeted by smiling, white, teeth and faces in every shop they go into. The lovely thing I think about the illustrations is that we see them warts and all. So we're seeing what the printer would see. They've been framed for the exhibition. They're float mounted. We see the edges of the artwork. So we see more than would be reproduced in the book. So we see the edges where the illustrator's kind of tested his paintbrush out on the edge. We see scribbles and notes to the printers. And these are things that just don't really exist in a digital world. So there is a sense of the craftsmanship. You know, your eye immediately goes to the image and the happy scenes. But as you pull back, you see, wow, this is real artwork. This is on artboard. These things have been painted with gouache, with watercolors, in some cases with oil paints. And yeah, this idyllic scene, the kids don't argue. They happily accompany mother to every single shop on the high street. One of the scenes I particularly like is that, of course, they're most rewarded at the end of the shopping with a visit to the toy shop. And what's rather brilliant, I think, about Lady Bird is that Lady Bird managed to ensure that across many series, Lady Bird books themselves would appear. So there's this kind of strange image of the two children staring into the window of a toy shop, longingly looking at model train sets, cars, dolls, furry animals, and of course a display of Lady Bird books. And then the final scene is they're back at home, they're emptying the wicker basket of shopping. It's an idyllic scene with the dog looking extremely happy they're back, and the cat kind of strangely sitting on a high stool at the table as well. How that was set up by the illustrator, I'll never know.
Maybe we can go and look at the People at Work series in a second, Lawrence. But there's an idea perhaps in that of the fact that jobs needed doing, and an idea of social cohesion. There's an idea of kind of almost sort of full employment, isn't there? I mean, not wanting to read too much into it, but I feel that there's sort of a political voice there. I mean, like with a very small p, I suppose. But nonetheless, there's an idea that everybody has their place, and this is what certain people do. And I think there is a sense that everybody's equal in that world, but that everybody needs to do something about it. We're surrounded by some pretty we'll maybe walk past Danger Men, as beguiling as it seems, and head to maybe something like The Miner.
John Berry was the illustrator. He illustrated the entire set. So that's 24 books in total. He was someone absolutely dedicated to doing first-hand research. So he went out, drew from life, photographed lots of people in their occupations. And for me, many of the most arresting images are some of the most banal, where you've got a scene with, particularly in The Miner, you've got a scene of a chap with a white coat with a hard hat on, standing alongside this huge ventilation shaft. There's really nothing much happening. And had Berry really considered that image, there may have been four or five more, I don't know, better vistas of that scene. But there's something really quite attractive from the perspective of just how ordinary it looks, because he's working from his own photographs. There's the kind of the glare of the flash coming off of the piping. There's the sense that this is just a moment in time. He's caught a moment in time that that's neither really exciting nor, well, it edges towards dull. But the idea that, you know, in a set of illustrations for a book, that 8-year-old kids would have been excited to see this image is kind of odd. You know, that's what's great, for me, is so great about this series. It's like discovering a time capsule of where Britain's workers were. I mean, another book, The Roadmakers, fascinating insight into a world where, you know, we were building motorways at a vast rate through the 60s. But I can't imagine a children's publishers these days, you know, a meeting where someone's pitching the idea of doing a very educational book about these chaps building roads.
There was the Flight series, which I remember, and which are sort of absolutely beautiful as well. And this tackles, you know, all the places that you might go to, obviously, on an aeroplane, whether it's a BOAC in those days or a British Airways flight, we'll have to see. Maybe you can talk us through one of these five flights.
The Flight series were five books in the entire series. There was Flight 1 Australia, 2 Canada, 3 the USA, India was number 4, and Africa number 5. And again, we've got a brother and sister duo, actually, interestingly, not depicted within a single one of the books. So the story is told from their perspective, but we never see them in the illustration. So unlike Peter and Jane, who are seen in every single part of the sequence, this couple basically taken on business trips with their father. So there was a sense that there was no real aspiration that young children could travel to far-flung corners of the planet as, you know, holidaying. They were taken on business trips by their father. And what's so amazing is that these were all, of course, former colonies. It's a particularly British sense of the world. Flight to Canada is amazing. There's a scene on an aircraft that, you know, today could only happen in business class, or certainly kind of maybe even first class. People are dressed up. There's a trolley, and I don't know if you've seen some of the scenes in Mad Men where they travel on flights, but that was how exciting and also how unobtainable flight travel, you know, travel by air was during the 1960s. We've got a fantastic image of New York at night. It's somewhere, it looks just off Times Square. It's chaotic. There's lots of traffic. It's nighttime. And there's a fantastic classic 50s car in the foreground and skyscrapers in the background. And, you know, that tells you everything you need to know about what New York was to kids in the 1960s.
And it seems that the world of Lady Bird is always, it's always got an educational side. There's not a great deal of escapism, even when we're talking about, you know, myths and fairy stories.
One of the great things about the world love tales, and there's always a story in there of good versus evil and good overcoming evil. It always does. And there were morals, there was something to be learnt from the morals in these tales. And really the direction that Lady Bird took when it understood it needed to do more than just entertain its young readers, but had a kind of moral crusade, if you like, to educate as well, across a vast number of different titles and series. The Lady Bird values, if you like, were to ensure that their readers got something from each book, and that Lady Bird was contributing to a younger generation's understanding of the world and maybe the gaps in knowledge that weren't coming through at the time in 1960s and 1970s schooling. But even within that, I think that there was a kind of sense of escapism for children, because the books were presented with such a kind of idyllic or utopian view, that maybe the escapism was actually in the, well, I'm learning something here as a seven-year-old, but this isn't my life that's being portrayed, and maybe that's where the escapism came in. They were seen as very, very wholesome products, very wholesome publications. So they were pocket money, and they were stocking fillers at Christmas. And what better way of winning over your grandchildren than buying them a Lady Bird book for Christmas or birthday?
That was Lawrence Zeegan, co-curator of that excellent exhibition, Lady Bird by Design, which is on at the De La Warr Pavilion in Bexhill-on-Sea until May this year. And Lawrence's book of the same name comes out in March.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Thirty years ago, people thought the Waterboys were going to be the next U2 on the back of a trio of epic questing albums, a self-titled debut, A Pagan Place, This Is the Sea. Mike Scott, the group's mainstay, reacted to the promise of packed stadiums by retreating to the west coast of Ireland and conjuring the modern folk classic Fisherman's Blues. Since then, Scott has upheld this refusal to do the same thing twice, or the expected thing once. The Waterboys' latest album, Modern Blues, is a southern soul stew recorded in Nashville with Muscle Shoals' former house bass player David Hood, no less. Mike Scott came to Midori House and spoke to Andrew Miller.
Her communique arrived with its expression of her feeling. I swear I had no idea she'd been holding and concealing. Such a storm of words unsaid, that absurd as it appears, had been blowing in her head for 27 years.
You recorded the new album, Mike, in Nashville. It's not the first time you've gone to America looking for inspiration after a bit of a layoff. I guess you did that with Dream Harder in 93 when you went to New York. But Nashville's associated with a very specific kind of sound. Is that what you were looking for when you went?
Well, that's the old story on Nashville. These days, Nashville's a cosmopolitan, all kind of music city. And unlike most modern cities, it's sustained its recording industry. It still has dozens of great studios with big rooms where a band can set up and play all at the same time. That was the way I wanted to work, so it was an easy decision to go to Nashville.
What was the process behind recruiting this incarnation of the Waterboys? Were you looking for musicians of that ilk as well, or did you just go to Nashville and see who you could find?
No, I already had the musicians picked out before I went there. See, in 2013 I did an American tour with the Waterboys where I used an American lineup. I liked the experience of working with American musicians, so I wanted to use some of those guys on the record. David Hood, who plays bass, came in at the last minute and needed a bass player, and our manager, who's based in America, suggested David and had worked with him before.
That difference you mentioned, the difference between American and British musicians, how would you characterise it?
It's a swagger thing. It's a sexy looseness to the way they play.
And with David Hood especially, I guess it's that Muscle Shoals rhythm section, isn't it? And that swagger does underpin all those great soul records that he played on.
That's right. I was listening to I'll Take You There by the Staple Singers last night, and his bass playing is the probably the single most identifiable thing in that record.
You married the wrong guy.
It's the first Waterboys with your words on it and your lyrics on it for quite a while. There was an appointment with Mr. Yates in 2011, on which, of course, you rather outsourced the lyric writing. Yeah. What kind of preoccupations had been percolating over that 8 years that you bring to the new record?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. Some people have said that some of the lyrics are occupied with the past. Well, maybe there's a bit of that, but some of them definitely aren't. To me, they're just a collection of songs. They're just the best of the songs that I'd written in that period.
Preoccupation with the past, though, which I have to say didn't strike me as an obviously dominant motif, but another thing you did do recently
Only a music journalist could say that. It's beautifully, beautifully put.
But another thing you did do recently, what was your autobiography, Adventures of a Waterboy, a couple of years ago. How did you find that as a process, a sort of sitting down and chronicling what is by now a quite long and quite extraordinary story? Did it surprise you at any point?
Yes, the surprises for me in writing my book were in which events became the hinge points that a chapter or a twist in the story would turn on.
Like what kind of things are you thinking of?
Well, some of them were obvious, like when I moved to Ireland in the mid-80s or when I went to Findhorn in Scotland in the 90s. But then there were other things like going and meeting my dad when I was in my late 30s. I hadn't seen my dad since I was a kid because he left home. Going and meeting him, that was an important thing. Of course, I knew it was an important thing in my personal life, but I didn't realise that it was important for me as an artist as well, because it enabled me to reach a new kind of sense of who I was, having found my dad again.
Out we jumped in the warm, mad night, hearing a wild tenor man's bawling horn across the way, and hands clapping to beat, and folks yelling, go, go, go. And far from escorting the girls into the place, Dean Moriarty was already racing across the street with his huge bandaged thumb in the air, yelling, blow, man, blow! And a bunch of colored men in Saturday night suits were whooping it up in front. And the behatted tenor man was blowing at the peak of a wonderfully satisfactory free idea.
I think it's either on the new album, it's either at the end of Nearest Thing to Hip or the beginning of Long Strange Golden Road.
Yes.
Is that a Kerouac quote?
It is, yes. It's Kerouac reading from On the Road. I read On the Road when I was 20, as with so many people. I absolutely loved the book, huge effect on me. And I reread it in 2007 when I was on tour, because they reissued it as the original scroll version. I don't know if you know, the legend is that Kerouac wrote the book in an amphetamine-fueled three-week burst, all in one computer roll of paper. And he edited it later, and the edited version is the famous book. But the original scroll version was kept, and they published it. It's a slightly more edgy version of On the Road. So I read that in 2007, just before I started writing the songs for this record. And the spirit of On the Road was definitely moving through me when I wrote the first couple of songs, and Long Strange Golden Road was one of those.
Okay. You are presumably about to tour with this album and with
yes.
this new lineup of the Waterboys.
Yep.
When you're putting together, I guess, a set list now and playing songs now, and I'm always interested in asking this question of musicians who have a history, because I think you may be among the last generation of musicians who get to have that kind of history and that decades-long relationship with an audience. Are you still able to, I guess, get yourself completely back into songs that you wrote half a lifetime ago now? Do they mean different things now, or is it a reconnection with the version of you who wrote it?
There is no time involved. It never strikes me that, gosh, it's 35 years since I wrote this. It's just like it was yesterday. It's still present for me. I don't have to work at it. They're still there. And certain songs I find are very easy still to perform because they're musically satisfying. Then there are others that are a bit musically thin that I don't enjoy. For example, one of my old songs was The Big Music from, I think it was written in 1983, and we rehearsed it with this band, with David Hood on bass and everything, and it really didn't work. It felt stodgy, and I realised the song just isn't quite musically fluent enough to sustain in live performance. And it was the same back in the mid-80s. I always would rehearse up that song and drop it really quickly because it never worked live. Interesting, it's the same now.
Just finally, the one song on the new album which did strike me as a fairly obvious statement of intent and quite obviously autobiographical, and I hope I'm not completely wrong about this, is the self-explanatorily titled Still a Freak.
Exactly, yes.
Was that kind of a note to self at this point?
Definitely. Do you know, there was a picture of me that Steve Wickham had sent to his wife for some reason, and she said, gosh, Mike is such a freak. And I knew exactly what she meant. She meant it in that late 60s sense. It was a picture of me. I'm wearing a cowboy hat and I'm looking sort of a bit spaced out. And he's such a freak. And I thought, yeah, man, I'm still a freak. I never went straight. And one thing leads to another and it becomes a song.
I'm still a freak.
That was Mike Scott of the Waterboys speaking to Andrew Muller, and their new record, Modern Blues, is out now. Coming up in the second half of the show, we meet the world's unluckiest man, who's the only person in his village not to win in the big Spanish lottery, and he's made a film about his misfortune, plus a couple more tracks from Alex Bury's Midori House session, and we'll take the temperature of This Is Art Week Singapore. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Music first, and another track from Alex Bury. We'll hear from him in conversation with Culture producer Holly in a moment, but for now, here he is with Unspoken.
Didn't I make you feel good? Didn't I make you feel loved? Oh, I never knew how to trust. I never knew what it would do to us. Didn't I make you feel special? Didn't I make you feel new? I never meant to break your heart. I didn't know what else to do. We have an unspoken beautiful thing.
We have an unspoken beautiful thing. I was growing, still young, and not knowing the pain I'd cause. And I'm sorry, oh I'm sorry, girl, I miss your gentle sweet whisper. I miss your genuine eyes. I miss the arms that wrapped me up and said goodbye. We have an unspoken beautiful thing. We have an unspoken beautiful thing. We have an unspoken beautiful thing. We have an unspoken beautiful thing.
Alex Bury, welcome to Midori House, and thank you for such a lovely session.
No, thank you for having me.
And you said that's the first performance you've done in quite a while.
Yeah, like a year. Well, yeah, I've done bits and bobs, but I find it hard performing to like a pub of like five people, just because even though it should be easier, it's just like more intense in a way, because it's all the locals who go to this pub, so you don't just like, you're interrupted then for a start. So yeah, has to just be spot on when like people are right in your face, do you know what I mean?
Has that always been your setup? You had quite a few band members with you today. Is that a new thing?
Yeah, because we all met at college, it was originally four of us. And then like, because I produce the music, I always want to try to get as much of everything in as I can. So there's like, yeah, it's six of us. I don't think I can afford to do that every gig. But while I can, I thought I'd get like a trumpet player in. Saxist.
Well, it sounded pretty nice.
So. Cheers, thank you.
Thanks for bringing them in. Let's talk a bit about your background, because you've been making music for years and years and years. I read somewhere that you've been producing songs since you were about 11 years old.
Yeah.
And you used to sort of be the local producer on the local grime scene.
That's like, yeah, when Unspoken came out, which is like a pretty standard love song, and then the caption to it was like grime producer. I started off just making really like really rubbish grime instrumentals and R&B and stuff, and because my area is, it's like a weird area just off the edge of Croydon, so there's not much music, or like no one really has studios around there. And it wasn't a studio, it was just like Cubase and then like one microphone. And then everyone would just come to my house just to record. But it ended up getting stupid, because I was like a really shy 11-year-old, and everyone in the area would just be like, go into his house. And I was too polite to be like, no, you can't come out.
What's your parents say?
No, yeah, well, they were a bit, I don't know, they were a bit weird. Once, like, I don't know, they did used to take the mic a bit, and like, I think my parents just got used to it. my parents were pretty scared of them.
And so I read that you still have your studio at the Boss Move Parents Garden in the shed.
Yeah, I originally had it in my room, and then last year it took about a year, because my uncle done it, it just took forever. So I have a nice little studio at the Boss Move Garden, which I'm just in all the time.
And that's where the whole EP was made?
Yeah, it was kind of, I don't know, I use my studio to kind of, if I'm in there for a night, I get down the ideas I want to and then re-record it at more professional studios. One track on there was done in Brooklyn by a band called The Dapkins. They done the intro. So yeah, they helped out with that, and then it's like band members jumping and stuff. So.
And yeah. So when you make, because your songs are quite rich with sound, you know, there's lots of different elements to them. Do you have an idea in your head before you go into the studio of what you want it to be, or do you sort of just build it up layer by layer, add things, take them out?
It's literally different every single time. Like, I want to get more into going back, because originally I wanted to just write songs on piano. So I want to go back to just focusing on writing a proper song. It's easy to just get a sample up and chop it up and go mad. And like, that's what I do. I do want to do a side project of just electronic stuff where I can just get all, because there's so many ideas that's just like I'm doing nothing with. Just put them out and then like focus on proper songwriting for my own stuff.
That was Alex Bury speaking to Monocle's Holly Fisher, and his new EP Inside World is out on the 9th of February. Go and buy it. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. You're about to hear a stranger than fiction tale from a small Spanish village in Aragon. No need to suspend your disbelief in order to enjoy the story, though. We can assure you that every single word is true. Back in December 2011, Spaniards gathered around their TVs for the announcement of the Christmas lottery, El Gordo, or the Fat One. It's the world's biggest and indeed oldest lottery, and is a nationwide cultural event. In this particular year, one village was celebrating louder than most, because every one of the town's residents had the winning numbers. That is, except for one very unfortunate Greek immigrant who hadn't bought a ticket. Dubbed the world's unluckiest man, Kostis Mitsotakis, a filmmaker, decided to turn his misfortune into an opportunity. He's been recording a documentary about the whole affair ever since. And now Liam Aldous travelled to Sodeto to meet with Kostis in his farmhouse studio, where he's been busy putting the finishing touches to Cuando Toco, which will be released later this year.
4 million. In Spain is literally a cultural event. I mean, there's people that they are taking the day off just to follow the lorry, just to hear the kids singing. And sometimes, if the big number doesn't come up really fast, they can stay like 6 hours watching it. I had this reaction is the first time I saw it. I say, what the hell is this? I mean, what are they sinking all the time, the numbers? I don't buy the lottery. I'm not into the lottery thing, which for the people here, it sounds extremely strange.
Well, as history shows, you didn't buy a lottery ticket that day, and it drastically affected your life in many unexpected ways.
Yeah, you could say that. I wouldn't change it, to be honest. So I didn't buy the lottery. And actually, it was the first time that I didn't buy the lottery, because spending like 7 years, give or take, in Sodeto, but I was living in the town, I had to buy it. The persons that sell it, they were coming, going from door to door, so you had to buy it. That's the first time that I'm living outside of the village, and they don't pass from here, so it was the first, actually, time that I didn't buy it. And, of course, the big one hit Sodeto.
So take me back to that day. Where were you when you found out? Did you get a phone call? Did you see it on the news? And what was the atmosphere like in the town?
It was nuts. It was everywhere. Everybody dancing, hugging, kissing. The bottles of champagne, it was like beers going around. And it lasted the whole day. The whole day they were having fiesta. The first that they found out and they arrived in Sodeto was the bankers. Weird as it sounds. Then you had the car salesman, and third, the reporters. And they stayed here for 3 days without leaving.
So you have a story about a small town of farmers. They pitch in for the world's richest lottery. We're talking about billions here.
20 Cent der Einsatz, Kleingeld. Dabei haben sie doch das ganz große Geld gewonnen.
Entire Spanish village has won the top prize in the world's biggest lottery. And it's not just any lottery, it's El Gordo, the fat one, probably the largest and oldest lottery in the world. It's about 247.
It's pretty interesting. It's like a small social study what happened in Sodeto. It took me like 4 hours to realize what actually is happening. And I always thought that they are overreacting, but that was happening because I didn't hear the numbers.
A lot of people who aren't familiar with the Spanish lottery wouldn't know that people go in to buy communal tickets. You can buy a tenth share of a ticket, or you can buy a whole ticket. So that determines how much you won. What were some of the figures being thrown around about the amounts that these small, very humble farmers were had won on this day?
Yeah, you have a little bit of everything. The poorest, the lowest number is 100,000 euros. But you have very few that they have only one participation, they call it, because, you know, they break it down because it's really expensive. I think it's 25 euros per ticket, which is 400,000 euros if you get the first prize. But in Soweto, you had families that they had from two tickets up to 40, which is like 4 million euros in a family. And you had also some funny stories of the first day realizing that you had like five tickets, and suddenly the grandma pops up and says, "Look, I found in my wallet four more." So it was going crazy, the whole thing.
Wait a minute, four more means just finding 400,000 euros in your pocket?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just like that.
You've been referred to in quite a few media reports as the unluckiest man, the most unfortunate man in the village, the biggest loser even. But you don't see it like that, do you?
No. It's not, for me, it's not like that. What happened in Soweto for me was like somebody was hand-giving me a script, a fantastic script. So for me to get the decision of, whoa, this is really interesting, I got to do something with that, it took me like 10 minutes. By the moment that I arrived in Soweto seeing this chaos, the moment that I realized the numbers, the moment actually that I realized that they are not overreacting, that is true, I just came with an idea.
It's been a few years since the town came into a lot of money, and you've been with your camera capturing the evolution of the town. How has it been? How easy has it been to gain access to your subjects and to basically record this story?
In general, I would say that it was easy, pretty easy. We really approached them softly, let's say, with the intention of doing this. And the interesting part is that the people of Soweto, I don't think, still, they are not realizing what we are doing. They know that we are making a movie documentary about it, but I don't think that they grasp the size of the whole project.
Have they been quite willing to participate?
Yeah. Everybody collaborating really with all their heart, no problems. We were getting more than what we were wishing for.
Do you think that's partly out of pity because they see you as the kind of the guy that missed out?
I wouldn't call it pity. I would call it a little bit of guilt, maybe. Although it's not a justifiable guilt, you know. I wouldn't blame them for nothing. But I think there is a small feeling in the air of, you know, he didn't have a ticket. Damn it. If you come now in Soweto and you don't know nothing about the lottery, you're not going to see nothing. It's exactly as it was before. The only evolution that it happened, it was that people is extremely more relaxed. And this is the approach we have as a topic, as a main topic in the documentary, but I cannot go into much details of...
We don't want to give the story away, but I mean, this is very interesting. How did it affect the social dynamic of the town?
You do see a little change, a little bit different on... Not on the social scale, but I think they closed down a little bit. The funny thing is that if you ask for the youngsters, let's say, of Soweto, it's the other way around. It brought them a little bit together. But I think one of the reasons that happened is the no worries. They're not having worries anymore. After the lottery, they brought a show car, a super expensive Jaguar. They put it in the middle of the village for people to see, just in case somebody will buy it or whatever. You have people looking at it, and suddenly one says that, why the hell are you bringing me that here? What am I going to do with that? Just bring me a tractor.
These are the lottery winners in Spain. This is sheer joy, ladies and gentlemen. This is the biggest lottery in the world.
That is a story that touches everybody. Everybody has this question of, what would have I done if I win the big one? For some, they're saying, okay, the numbers are not that big. But it's not about numbers. I don't think it's about numbers anymore. It's about a moment of your life. Surprises.
That was Kostis Mitsotakis speaking to Monocle's Liam Aldous. Look out for his film later this year. And after the break, we'll be checking out Art Week Singapore.
As Design Miami celebrated its 10th anniversary this year, Monocle Films explored new themes in the collectible design market.
I think that we're beginning to become more of a design-driven culture as we learn to consume more responsibly. We're beginning to learn that better design helps us actually live better. And I think America's finally waking up to that fact.
Pull up a chair to watch Design Miami 2014, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Singapore rounded up its annual Art Week on Sunday with more than 100 events, art fairs, auctions, screenings and awards. While Art Stage Singapore anchored the week's activities, there was no shortage of interesting things to see and do. Monocle's Jason Lee was on the ground from the beginning when things kicked off at the pop-up music festival called Super Zero.
Since 2013, art collectors, buyers and enthusiasts flock to Singapore every January for the annual Art Week. It just took place last week. Spread across the island, it's a smorgasbord of art in its various forms. This year, visitors can sample over 100 separate activities, from auctions and art fairs to screenings and pop-up festivals. This third edition is the biggest Art Week the island has seen yet, and nothing better than a massive party called Super Zero to kick off festivities. I spoke to festival director Alyssa Kokila to find out what it's all about.
Super Zero was meant to be a platform for fresh talent across the music, arts, culture and design. We want to transform different places and not make it too predictable, because we felt we're having traveled to lots of festivals around the world, we were inspired by the way people did stuff, combining different disciplines and different ways people experience, whether it's nightlife, entertainment or culture, performance art, theatre, anything. Because we kind of felt like we can do it as well, Yeah, so why not?
And now you're kickstarting Singapore Art Week. Tell us a little bit about this space. Where are we now? It's quite interesting.
Yeah, we're basically at the former Singapore Airlines Sports Club. It's been vacant for about 6 to 7 years. We work closely with a lot of government agencies. Singapore Land Authority is one of them, SLA. So we work with them and we ask them hey, do you have any interesting spots that are vacant that we can kind of take over? And they have a full list they share with us. And we go down and we just see, what speaks to us. The moment we saw this place, oh my God, we have to transform it. We've always wanted to move away from the fact that, we're not just a rave festival I don't want to drop names, but other festivals where they just focus on just music and having fun. We wanted to do that, but at the same time, we wanted to have programming where when people come down, we wanted to pique their curiosity. We wanted them to leave the event feeling I saw Pandemonium, a theatre performance art thing, and maybe I might want to check them out. What is this? And it's kind of reaching out to a different group of people that you normally wouldn't reach out to. Because sometimes a lot of people think, Art Stage, which is the anchor of Singapore Art Week, it's a bit cheeky, it's a bit posh. It kind of intimidates certain people. Our crowd is a little more, maybe I would say, easygoing.
Anchoring Art Week is Art Stage Singapore, a massive art fair that features more than 150 galleries from the region and further afield. The founder is Lorenzo Rudolph, who used to direct Art Basel. I spoke with him and asked him why he decided to launch Art Stage Singapore, and we talked about art in the region.
That is a very, very long history, which started surely somewhere with the beginning of my career in Basel, and then in America, then in Shanghai. I think in all this time you realize how the society is functioning, how this world is changing, and especially also how the art world and the art market is adapting itself to all these changes. It was clear already in the 90s that we want to have an increasing shift economically, politically, but also culturally towards Asia. And the question was not Asia or not, the question was when. And I started 2007 together with three partners, the first big event in Asia, in Shanghai. And already there we saw things are moving. And this event in Shanghai was very successful, but we split it because of personal reasons. And it was clear for me, I want to continue in Asia. And then was the question, what is the right place? We started this event in Shanghai because at this time, China was really the booming market or the booming place. But it was clear already there that in the future, for the quite long time. Probably there will be only two places where you can really do an international event. That's Hong Kong and that's Singapore.
And what's new this year at ArtStage Singapore?
I think there are two, three things which are new, but in a certain way, a logical continuation of what we do. For example, the Southeast Asian platform. It's now the third time that we do it, but we do it in a much advanced way than ever. I think nowhere until now an art fair was doing a really academical show, a real museum exhibition, as we do here, with an academic approach, a thematic approach, a curator who really approached this exhibition like in a museum, where everything is for sale. And not only that, it is an exhibition which has really to integrate emerging art for Southeast Asia. You really can discover it here. And I think that's something which goes much, much further than ever done on every art fair. Also we, when we did this platform, it was much, much more accumulation of wonderful works. But it was really never the clear classical academic approach. Many of these artists, there were kids growing up with MTV. That means multimedia is a medium which is normal, logical for them, usual for them. Video multimedia became a medium which is very, very used even more, but in the art market, in art fairs, in galleries, you don't see a lot of videos because it's very difficult to show and especially difficult to sell. That's the reason why we started something called the Video Stage, which shall become an institution also in the future, where we want to really give the opportunity to show and to see a lot of videos from all over Asia, of all over Southeast Asia, but all from all over the world. ArtStage Singapore is not only a market platform bringing together buyers and sellers. How I see it is like in the old Rome, the Forum, or in the old ancient Athens, the Agora. It's a place where you trade and exchange everything. Merchandise, ideas, discussions, and when new things start, I think that has to be ArtStage. And at the end, that has to be Singapore.
That was Monocle's Jason Lee reporting from Art Week Singapore. Bring us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bowne. My producer was Holly Fisher. I feel like I've won El Gordo every week. I've always won the lottery with this producer. Time for one final song for this week's Midori House session. Here is Alex Bury with Family Stone. Thanks for tuning in.
Grow as one, may my love run through all of you. Paint these pages inside that remind myself of a time and health where I was alive. Heaven has grown out of my soul. Heaven won't grow out of my home. One of these days I'll see finally my whole heart was behind me. Still trying to make sense of it all. Brother, trying to forget and move on and be strong. Oh, be strong for me. Heaven has grown out of my soul. Heaven won't grow out of my home.
heart was behind me. My whole heart was in time for you.
Thank you.